Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 107 for Tuesday, June 28th, 2011. I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
We have three stories to talk about this week, including a Second Circuit case on the hot news doctrine, DMCA takedown requests against Peanut Twitter, and the FBI raid that took down Instagram and Pinboard. So let's get started. This week, the Second Circuit issued an opinion in Barclays v. TheFlyOnTheWall.com. This is a complex case and a somewhat new topic to our show. So first I'm going to give a little background on what the hot news doctrine is, and we'll give a quick recap of what the facts in the case, and then I'll just throw it to the panel. So to start us off, the hot news doctrine is a cause of action under state common law for the misappropriation of time-sensitive factual information. It's a judicially created concept, and it aims to provide some protection to news-gathering entities who spend time, money, and resources gathering news, but only to have a competitor free ride off of their efforts. The hot news doctrine has existed in some form since the mid-19th century. In 1918, the Supreme Court formally recognized the concept in a case known as International News Service v. Associated Press. Following this case, news-gathering entities were able to claim misappropriation of hot news, and it's entirely distinct from copyright infringement, so it is, in a pure sense, a state common law cause of action. And this is important because the Copyright Act affords very little protection, or at least limited protection, to factual information. Instead, it protects the expression of that of those facts. But even if you are copying directly the expression of factual information, either in whole or in part, a claim of copyright infringement will still be subject to the fair use doctrine. So it's not always clear, even if you have a case where there's whole copying, whether it would be successful in the merits in an infringement action. So the next significant development occurred in the 1970s, just after the 1976 copyright was enacted. This was the next major overhaul in the of the Copyright Act, and Congress added a couple of new provisions in the Act, including Section 301, which is known as the Express Preemption Section. And that prohibits states from recognizing legal or equitable rights that are the equivalent to the exclusive rights in the Copyright Act. And after this, and this is why this provision is important, courts generally started to chip away at the hot news doctrine, since it claims a right that is very close to the right to distribution under the Copyright Act. And we can talk a little bit more about how that works when we start talking about the case. But what's important here is that the hot news doctrine was heavily neutered after the 76 Act was enacted. And in order to get around the new preemption express preemption section, causes of action had to include additional elements beyond those but would comprise a claim for copyright infringement. Now, though, going ahead to present day, there are about four or five states that recognize some form of a hot news claim. Those include New York, California, Illinois, Missouri, and there might be one other that I am forgetting. But most states recognize this New York cause of action for hot news. And that was what was directly at issue in this case, Barclays v. The Fly on the Wall. And so TheFlyOnTheWall.com is this website that you can subscribe to get information related to securities, trading, and investments. Basically, they put together these reports and they send them out to subscribers. Well, it turns out that that is very close to what Barclays and a number of other major investment firms do every day for their clients and for prospective clients that are trading on the markets. And what the investment firms do is very similar. They employ hundreds of analysts to put together reports related to companies that are on these publicly traded markets, and they talk about what might be good purchases for on the day and what companies are doing well, what companies are not doing well. That gets published and sent out to these clients and prospective clients before the markets open every single day. And that was exactly the same service that The Fly on the Wall was offering, but according to the court documents, TheFlyOnTheWall.com was obtaining, in some cases, some of these reports from the private investment firms like Barclays, and then incorporating some of the recommendations they were making to clients and prospective clients into their own reports, and then sending them out to their subscribers, and you would subscribe for several hundred dollars a month. And that's where the firms came in and made a claim before the Southern District of New York at the district court level. And that court entered an injunction and enjoined the flyinthewall.com from publishing the reports until more than a half hour after the markets opened. So, in other words, they were sort of recognizing that there is some commercial value to obtaining these reports from the investment firms like Barclays prior to the markets opening. And there was some damages in the case. Also, it was a small amount of damages, if I recall correctly, probably about between $10,000 and $15,000 worth of damages. And right after that, theflyinthewall.com appealed the case. And that's where we are now. And the Second Circuit issued its opinion this week and reversed the district court holding. Now we can throw this over to the panel and we can talk about what exactly happened at the Second Circuit. So I guess my first question to you guys is there a hot news doctrine anymore?
Yes.
Yeah, this opinion did not explicitly get rid of the hot news doctrine. It left it open to, a future case.
Yeah, basically, in a nutshell, they basically said, all right, so these financial firms, they're telling their clients these recommendations. By doing so, they themselves are creating news. Merrill Lynch recommends that you buy Google. And the fly on the wall is just reporting on that news. It's interesting that since the fly on the wall got sued by them a couple years ago, and they did this for a while, they changed what they were doing. Originally, they had employees within who were subscribed to these organizations' news feeds just email them. And then when they got sued, they changed their tactics. Instead, what they did was they went and researched without trying to get the primary source, basically looking anywhere they could from the secondary source to see what the recommendations were, because they didn't want to be accused of leaving themselves open to actually looking at the recommendations. So instead, they looked at what the Wall Street Journal would report or other news sources would report about what these companies' recommendations were, perhaps asking people who received the recommendations without seeing the recommendations themselves. In other words, doing sort of investigative reporting. So the distinction here is that what's at issue is the actual fact of the recommendation. That in itself forms a news item. And because that's a fact, and fact can't be protected by copyright law, only the expression, that means that they kind of sidestep the hot news aspect of it.
Right, and I could go over what the elements of the cause of action for a misappropriation of hot news is under New York law. You need to have, first of all, a significant expenditure in the news gathering or collection process, then the news or information must be time sensitive in some way. Then the defendant in the case, the person who's being accused of misappropriation, has to free ride on the material that's been collected by the plaintiff. And then the free riding has to compete directly with the plaintiff's own market. And it has to also be likely to diminish the incentive to gather or collect news in a timely manner in the future. Now, so if you look at if you think about those elements, they've added a couple of elements to make the action distinct from an action of copyright infringement. So if you were claiming that somebody was unlawfully distributing your material, your expression, without your consent, they've added a few elements to it, including the time-sensitive nature of the information, and it has to also be likely to diminish the incentive to gather or collect news in the future. The Second Circuit in this case kind of had a roundabout way of deciding it. First of all, they declined to opine on the validity of the hot news doctrine on the whole. They said that's probably more of an issue for the New York Court of Appeals, the same Supreme Court level of every other state, but they call it the Court of Appeals. They then decided, well, let's take a look at these elements and see if they've actually met the elements of a claim for misappropriation of hot news. And one of the things they looked at was what it was that the financial firms were trying to protect. And they said that really what they were trying to protect is these recommendations, which weren't necessarily factual information. They were more of a compiled recommendation, something that they had created themselves. Time-sensitive information necessarily, it was recommendation, so closer to expression. And that became one of the points at which the Second Circuit said, you're really getting too close to a claim of copyright infringement here, and the express preemption provision in the Copyright Act is pretty clear. They did away with the case on those grounds, but I think a bunch of commentators are now calling into question whether the doctrine will continue to survive after this, though.
Yeah, it's tough to imagine the instances where hot news survives in, you know, the modern news economy, the way that news is generated and distributed these days.
Yeah, I mean, the newspapers, it's a crisis for them right now. They have seen declining revenues over the last 10 years or so, and people are looking for a new way to protect the content that they're producing. And, you know, there's some merit to the fact that a lot of the big media organizations do put a lot of resources and invest a lot of money into the news gathering process. You'll hear people from the industry and commentators who are sort of pro, you know, the pro big media organizations say that if you don't have a tort-like misappropriation of hot news, it's just completely going to destroy the industry because now with online news distribution, you know, it's much more instantaneous. We get our news as it happens. We can go to Twitter, we can go to the AP or even Reuters who are distributing what amount to, in some cases, is just rewritten articles. They're getting their information from these large media entities that are investing all the resources in the news gathering process and then rewriting the stories, and it has such limited protection under the Copyright Act that there's no way to stop it. And they view it as a loss of investment.
Well, the concern, and I mean, the hot news doctrine is pretty old. It dates back to 1918, I think, if I'm not wrong. The concern is that if you don't protect hot news, so to speak, the people who go out and put the effort in getting that hot news are not going to bother anymore. In other words, you're killing the goose that laid the golden egg by just not letting them, by not giving them some sort of protection. But at the same time, facts are not protectable under copyright law. So there's a careful balance there.
Yes, and actually, I think the doctrine dates back even way before the Supreme Court case. I think it was first recognized in the mid 1800s, so it has been around for quite some time. So, you know, I don't necessarily buy the argument that this will completely disincentivize news gathering because I think where there's a market for something, someone's going to find a way to exploit it, and they will find a way to capitalize on it. And just because it's no longer the same organizations that have been doing this the last several hundred years, you know, I don't know that it necessarily disincentivizes a news gathering process at all.
Right, well, the death of a business model is not necessarily the death of the business, but a lot of the old players that have been at this for 100, 200 years, and they're not used to the business model shifting underneath their feet and will generally cry out to the courts for protection.
Yeah, I think people today are a lot more concerned with the. I mean, for certain news, they just want to hear what the news is. For other news, they're more concerned about the perspective of the person who's giving it to them. And that's why Fox News and MSNBC are, you know, regularly getting higher ratings than CNN because, you know, they've got clear perspectives or, you know, bias or whatever you want to call it. And you know, people are looking for high quality news report. When they're looking for news reporting, they're looking for high quality news. They're looking for news with a perspective. When they're looking for just news, you know, they can go anywhere for it.
And if you use Google News at all, and I'm a heavy user of Google News, and Google even sort of organizes the headlines for you, and it doesn't necessarily put the top media organizations at the top of a headline, in sort of like these nested headlines where you have one major one, and then it notes the other entities that are also reporting on this. And frankly, you know, I don't always really care about where I'm getting it from. There are some instances where I'm more likely to, you know, go to the Washington Post or the New York Times, but if it's coming from, you know, some smaller media organization that solely does online content distribution, I don't mind so much as long as I'm getting accurate news, and I kind of rely a bit on Google's algorithm to tell me what is accurate, what are people reading.
Yeah, and Google's algorithm also will take into account what you click on, so it'll eventually bias towards your own biases, so you'll only see news sources that favor your particular perspective. It's kind of interesting.
Although they do offer a way to depersonalize the Google News page. I don't know how accurate that is or what it actually does, but. So in any event, I guess, you know, we'll have to see what happens to the hot news doctrine, but it doesn't look like it's doing very well, especially considering most of the other states that still recognize the hot news doctrine recognize the New York version of it.
Anything
Any final
else?
thoughts?
I'm all set.
All set here. Can take us away to our next story, which concerns news or humor on a completely new medium, Twitter. The Peanut Twitter story. Apparently there were Peanut Tweeter, sorry. There was a Peanut Tweeter Twitter and a Tumblelog. And basically what the guy would do is he would take old Peanuts, Charlie Brown comic strips, look around for interesting tweets, and then edit out the original text from the comic strip and put in the tweet and credit the tweeter. So you'd see stuff like Linus and Charlie Brown reclining against a tree, and instead of the original dialogue, it would say, "Remember when science tried to make us switch to the more etymologically correct Aptosaurus, and we all went blow us Brontosaurus forever?" And then it would credit the particular tweeter. And while retaining, I mean, it would mention that it was obviously by Schultz, and essentially this was parody. Fair use, that's what he thought, that's why he was like, oh, this is not going to be a problem. Well, it didn't turn out that way, because Iconics Incorporated, which I believe owns the copyrights on the Peanuts characters and the comic strip, filed a DMCA claim with Tumblr, which was where it was hosted, and shut down the Tumblr. They had to remove all the Peanut tweets. So, thoughts on this? From the panel.
Well, first of all, I thought it was pretty clever what the guy was doing. It was funny. You know, I felt bad that the first time that I saw this case was after it had already been taken down, because I saw some of the archives and they were pretty humorous.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a really cool reinvention of an old comic strip. Ben?
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of underscores this ever-growing battle that we're seeing between remix culture and traditional copyright. These were using one frame of the original comic of, you know, hundreds of, you know, frames that were created. I mean, each one of these, if I understand it correctly, was using a different frame. But they'd replace the original text with the tweet. I don't know if it's fair use. My guess is there's some care that went into picking out the frames to pair with the with the tweets, and you know, the Peanuts did have this kind of commentary on the universe that, you know, one could be making fun of by using tweets instead of the original Peanut quotations. But you know, I feel like people are a little too protective with that content sometimes. If it's not hurting anyone. If anything, again, it's the old argument that it's bringing more attention to Peanuts.
I mean, would it even be clear? It would depend a lot on the context in which you see the frame, the new frame that's been created using the tweet. And if it's not clear to the reader that it's not Charles Schultz who has created the frame, someone might erroneously think it was. And some of the tweets were sort of offensive, too. They weren't exactly using family-oriented language.
No, they weren't. Twitter doesn't necessarily. But the creator basically said the reason he did this was because he felt that these were tweets that should be recognized for their particular humor value, and that people would identify with them more if they came from familiar characters, such as the Peanuts gang. So in a real sense, he is sort of using the appeal, the common shared cultural consciousness of the Peanut, I can't believe I just said that, of the Peanuts to make them more identifiable with the tweet.
That was very deep.
Yeah.
Or more simply, he's just using the Peanuts frames as a vehicle then to get, you know, these tweets out, which he's also borrowing from other people. I don't know where I fall on this yet, but if you think about the fair use factors, this doesn't seem terribly transformative to me. All it's doing is removing the text that was there previously and then adding in the tweets. Okay, you have that, but as you noted before, it's not necessarily commenting on Peanuts. It's more using the work as a means of conveyance. And I think that's where it really starts to run afoul. If you compare that to something like Garfield minus Garfield, that very much is just, it's just removing Garfield from the comics, and then you see John, you know, sort of talking to himself, and it appears to be this, like, very depressed guy who, you know, doesn't really like life very much. That seems to me to be commenting much more about John in the comic, and it's not necessarily using sort of the comic as a that Jim Davis created as a vehicle to do something else.
Well, I think it ultimately comes down to holders, and Jim Davis liked Garfield minus Garfield, so he didn't sue them out of existence. Whereas here, Charles Schulz unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, so we just have a faceless corporation protecting his rights.
Yeah, well, as far as we know, there might be some involvement of the family still, but in any case, it just appears to be a faceless corporation. And I guess it's kind of a close case. There have been other comics out there that have sort of successfully done this right. You know, I mentioned Garfield minus Garfield. There's also a Dysfunctional Family Circus. Does that sound right? There's another one I saw years ago using the Family Circus comic.
I thought Dysfunctional Family Circus was shut down, but let me check. No, it looks like there are at least still archives of it.
Yeah, once something gets posted on the internet, it basically can never die. Although, sometimes you might have to look very hard to find it. But, I mean, is this parody? Is this fair use? Or is this fair use because it's parody, rather? Returning to Peanut Tweets.
Well, I don't fully see, I guess, the parody argument there. And how much is it actually commenting on Peanuts?
At least some.
I mean, it's definitely a transformative use in terms of it's something other than it would have been before, right? I mean, our factors are purpose and character, including whether it's commercial, the nature of the copyrighted work itself, the amount used, here it's just all the art, none of the dialogue, and the effects of the use upon the potential market for the value of the copyrighted work. I would actually argue that it increases the value of the Peanuts comic strip because people will be more likely to be like, hey, where was the original comic strip? I want to go buy a book and read up, and so I can find the original comic strip. Because I want to see how it
this. The flip side of that argument, Dominic, is of course they could have licensed it. So, you know, it has some effect on the fact that this was not a licensed use of the frames.
That's true, but I strongly doubt that a license would have been granted. But that isn't an argument, I know.
Yeah, and I agree with you.
So, Ben, you think that there is some commentary, though, on Peanuts?
I think it's either commentary or parody of Peanuts. Because, you know, so much of Peanuts was, you know, these kids having very deep philosophical conversations, which Twitter in many ways is the opposite of. So by juxtaposing the shallow, often humorous commentary that happens on Twitter with the kind of, you know, deep thoughts of the children in the Peanuts, I think it has some artistic merit.
Okay, I'd say that's probably a fair argument. I think it's a little bit less overt, though, because you have to read into the comic a bit, and you'd have to know the context. And Peanuts, it's been around for a very long time, decades, and they stopped circulating or stopped publishing after Schulz died, but probably
no,
in the late
I mean,
90s.
They're still doing repeats in newspapers.
Reprints.
They're just obviously not doing new ones. But it's still syndicated and it's still being published regularly.
I guess I was just sort of idly wondering how much of the Twitter generation is really familiar with Peanuts.
Do we count as part of the Twitter generation? Or are they younger than we are?
I don't know. It was a very idle question. It wasn't very well thought through, but I guess it's mostly people in the 20s to 30s range, so probably those folks, us, would be in the Twitter generation and probably familiar with Peanuts.
Yeah, I mean, we all grew up with Peanuts in the newspaper when we still got newspapers delivered to our house, and we all grew up with, you know, it's a very Charlie Brown Christmas or, you know, whatever that was, the Great Pumpkin and things.
I mean, I think part of this comes down to just the way the DMCA is structured. If you get a takedown notice, it gets taken down. You can file a counter takedown notice later, but the immediate damage of it getting taken down is done. I don't know whether the creator is filing a takedown or a counter takedown notice.
He's not. Yeah, he's already announced that he's going to stop the production of the strip.
I wonder why. Why doesn't he want to file a counter takedown notice?
Well, you know, it was interesting. There were a lot of commentary from the Twitterverse, I guess you could say, back to him about why people thought it wasn't a transformative use, and he's noted this on his Tumblr, Tumblr page, and I think on the Twitter account that he was using. And he put up a couple of posts saying that he was basically going to shut it down after getting the cease and or the DMCA takedown, took down all of the content that he had produced. So I don't think he wants to fight it, because that's the next step to this, is that, okay, what if, you know, they file a lawsuit and you have to bear the legal expenses of going through it, and then just because of the unpredictable nature of the fair use doctrine, you have to go through a case for copyright infringement and have a judge tell you that, you know, one use is a fair use. Because it's just so time-consuming and expensive, I don't think he was willing to do it. On the other hand, I do think he's supposed to appear on Twill this upcoming Friday. So you could probably hear more from him during that show.
Any last thoughts before we move on to the last story?
All set.
All set.
Okay, so this last story is about an FBI raid that happened on June 23rd. And the FBI raided a hosting company called Digital One, and it's believed that the raid was in conjunction with the LulzSec group that has since actually said that they will be disbanding, although who's to know, you know, what reincarnations will come back of them and whether or not they're actually disbanding or just saying that they are. So what happened is FBI got some sort of tip that there was LulzSec was using servers hosted at Digital One. They went into Digital One, apparently took pretty much an entire rack of servers out without regard to which servers were actually being used by LulzSec. And as a result, Instapaper, a program that lets you save articles that you're reading for later use on other devices, was taken down. Also, well, the server was taken, the service remained up because it was well made and distributed. Another service called Pinboard, which is similar, it's more social. You basically, it's kind of like a bookmark sharing site. That service was taken down for a period of time as a result of this. Now, it's worth mentioning that since then, I'm sorry, the raid was not on the 23rd, the raid was before then. It was late on the 22nd. The following day, however, the servers were returned. The servers did, the Instapaper server came back online. It was apparently, the physical server was returned to the host. Do we have any initial thoughts on this? You know, is the FBI going to be in any trouble for taking more servers than they should have in this raid?
So can you clarify something for me? The websites actually did go down.
Pinboard did go down. Instapaper was working slower than it should, but was still up the entire time.
Yeah, Pinboard basically is a new Delicious, by the way. It was created because Delicious started to suck more and more.
Right. It's also easier to share links with friends on Pinboard than it ever was on Delicious.
I mean, who can hurt the FBI in this sense? Like,
well, I
mean,
the first thing that I thought of when I heard about this was a case from, it was early 90s. It was Steve Jackson Games v. Secret Service. And this is a notably different case. So basically, this was, I want to say, after the electronic, Act was this under. Basically, the Secret Service was following a threat that was made on a bulletin board system hosted by Steve Jackson Games, and Steve Jackson is a game designer. In 1990, his case was Steve Jackson's place was raided, and his servers were seized by the Secret Service, and the Secret Service did not follow proper procedures. And as a result, the Secret Service was hit with a large, about $50,000 in damage and about $250,000 in attorney's fees. And there was a statutory basis in this case for those damages against the government. As I mentioned, these cases are not identical in any way. My question is, what are the repercussions from this for the FBI or for, you know, the game? Not the game makers, for Pinboard and Instapaper.
Well, my understanding is they were seizing servers at a particular location, and they just seized extra servers than the ones that they had authority to seize.
Right, that's my understanding as well.
Yeah, and then that would probably be my next question. I mean, what happened when the FBI came in? It, because there are formal procedures that should probably be followed in these cases, and you know, it would be nice to know if there was a warrant or not.
Yeah, my guess is there was a warrant for specific servers, and the FBI. I would not be surprised if the FBI busted in, showed the warrant, grabbed, the server rack and left. In cases like this, you generally want to move very quickly so that people don't have time to destroy any data. And there are two ways of doing that. You can do it in such a way. You can do it like, this, where you move in very quickly and you move out, or you can, move in very early in the day, kind of secure everything, and then take your time.
As I suppose it's possible that Pinboard could eventually sue the FBI then for, you know, losing service, a disruption of service.
How, on what grounds, though?
Well, if they weren't following procedures, then it would be an unlawful search and seizure, and it would be a deprivation of property.
Right, and that's exactly what it would be. If the warrant did not include the Pinboard servers or the Instapaper servers, it would just be a simple God, it's the federal government, so it would be like a Bevin's action for deprivation of rights, for deprivation of Fifth Amendment rights to Fourth Amendment right, sorry, due process. And I guess to clarify something, when a state does this, you bring what's called a what is it, a 1983 action. So it's 18 U.S.C. 1983 that lets you sue the state for a deprivation of due process or taking away property without just compensation. That statute doesn't apply to the federal government, so there's a common law, kind of like a common law action called a Bevin's action that lets you pursue the government for that type of thing. I think it's called the Bevin's action. This is all Fed courts, and it's been a very long time since I've had to use that.
The other question I had lingering in my head was, this wasn't like a an instance where the CPUs on the rack might have been shared, right? It could be the case that there were
It
multiple, you know,
was
virtual
a
servers running on the same box.
dedicated, it was a dedicated server in this case.
Yeah, that is pretty funky then.
Okay, so it's Bivens, Bivens, and the Supreme Court ruled that there's an implied cause of action for individuals whose Fourth Amendment freedom from unreasonable search and seizures had been violated by federal agents. The victim could sue for the violation of the amendment itself, despite lacking any federal statute authorizing the suit. And it's been since been expanded to include other rights other than just Fourth Amendment right to freedom from unreasonable search and seizures.
So, do you guys think, what do you guys make of the whole LulzSec thing? I mean, do you think these guys are going to be tracked down eventually, and that's why they're running, if they are in fact running,
Probably.
assuming everything was true that they said yesterday?
I think they're going to split off and form their own groups and probably try to keep a slightly lower profile in the future.
This was a splinter, right? I mean, as far as people know, people are saying that it's been a splinter from Anonymous.
I guess I didn't realize that.
Yeah, Ryan Cleary, who was arrested for in the UK, I think the week before, he apparently was one of the former Anon Ops guys who was running the IRC channels, and they're claiming that it was like a loose affiliation, but it was still like a linking of, you know, this guy wasn't closely affiliated with LulzSec. Nonetheless, the guy was affiliated previously with Anon Ops, which kind of links the two groups together a bit. For whatever that's worth, though, I mean, a number of people close to the source have sort of said that, you know, there's a strong tie of affiliation between Anonymous and this new LulzSec group.
Apropos of nothing, I was listening to some NPR stories where they were using the word hacktivist, hackers who are also activists, and they were kind of applying it to LulzSec, and I'm like, I really don't think that's what they're doing. I think they're just being tools.
Well, actually, they did take down the government of Tunisia's website after they were, I think, engaging in some heavy filtering. They have been actually involved in a number of DDoS attacks related to hacktivist-like causes.
Okay. So it's not
And
all
yeah,
just
they are generally
griefing.
considered. Right. They're generally considered to be a hacktivist organization along with Anonymous, because they're not doing this for financial gain, they're just doing it. And in some cases, it seems to be politically motivated, even though that some of those motivations are don't always make logical sense. It seems to be rationalized by the actors themselves as being politically motivated.
Cyber
Hence,
terrorists.
hacktivist. Oh, yes.
Cyber terrorists. I mean, it sucks for Instapaper and Bitboard. I mean, the FBI hasn't given the servers back. That's the
No,
biggest thing.
Instapaper did get their server back. I have no
Oh, they
idea if
did.
Pinboard did. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. When I last checked up on this, they hadn't.
Yeah, but since then, Marco's told the Digital One that he's, canceling their accounts and he's going to be moving his servers over to other places and trying to encrypt them, more strongly. Because while all of the user information was encrypted, the actual content that the users had saved was stored in the clear.
Yeah. I certainly wouldn't have foreseen while developing what happens if the FBI seizes my server? How should I protect? Like, what? It's just not something you foresee when you're developing code.
Right, or at least it's not something that you should have to foresee if you're developing some sort of entirely legal system.
Right.
So, any last thoughts on these, David?
No, I think I'm all set here. It's just kind of a bummer of a story to hear when your website goes down because of an FBI raid of something not related at all to what you do or what you have done.
Okay, Dominic?
All set here.
Okay, in that case, I would like to thank everyone for joining us for this, the 107th Technically Legal Podcast. As always, you can find us online, www.technicallylegal.org. You can find us on Twitter, @TechLegal. If you have any questions, comments, story suggestions, please email them to podcast@technicallylegal.org. Signing off, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.